The Steve Lobby Agency presents The Christian Publishing Show, a podcast for writers who want to advance Christ's kingdom using the written word. Here's your host, Thomas Umstadt Jr.
First off, I'd like to apologize for the fact there was no episode last week. I was recovering from a trip to the ER and was in no state to make a podcast. So I do apologize. But I am excited about this episode. The document that led to this episode is something I've been working on for 5 years. In fact, it was one of the first projects I worked on with the woman who is now my wife. It was something she edited or gave me feedback on years ago. And it's kind of sat on my hard drive all this time with very few people seeing it. It's something I've shared with a select few, but now I am sharing it with you. And it is a Christian author's guide to the homeschool market. The homeschool market for many Christian authors can seem like the promised land. Here is a market that buys millions of Christian books every year. And if you are an author and you're able to get accepted by this market, there is a lot of impact you can make and money you can make and lives that you can affect. But how do you do that, right? For a lot of authors, looking at the homeschool market seems like a lot of businesses looking at the Chinese market, right? If you're an international business, you're like, wow, if we could only get 1% of China to buy our product, we would be rich. There's over a billion people there. And how hard could it be to get only 1% of all of those people? Then those companies slap Chinese labels on their products only to watch them fail in the Chinese market. Why? Because China is different and homeschool culture is a different culture. It's different cultures. We're going to talk about the different kinds of homeschoolers here in a moment. And to succeed into selling to any culture, you need to understand that culture. And if you want to understand a subculture, the same is true. Now, I want to talk a little bit about why the homeschool market is so important, and it's simply because they buy so many books. It's not uncommon for homeschoolers to walk away from the library with dozens of books every few weeks. They're huge users of the library. My homeschool mom has purchased perhaps 4,000 books over the last 20 years, maybe more, maybe a lot more. She has an entire room of her house dedicated to books with shelves covering every wall, this is not uncommon. This is not something weird about my mom. This is normal. When homeschool moms walk into my parents' house, they nod approvingly at the library. They're like, oh yes, we have a library just like this. So while the typical house may have a bookshelf full of books, maybe two bookshelves full of books, if they are big readers. For homeschool families, they have maybe half a dozen bookshelves full of books, maybe a dozen bookshelves full of books. That is a lot of books. These are the kinds of readers you want reading your book. It's not uncommon for homeschool moms to brag about their book buying problems, right? They're very frugal in a lot of ways, and yet they spend a lot of money on books. And lately, a lot more homeschool moms are getting into book writing, especially as the first generation of homeschool students grow up and move out. Their moms are writing a lot of books. I'm running into a lot more homeschool moms at writers' conferences or former homeschool moms, right? They homeschooled for many years and now their children are up and out of the house, or at least they're up and no longer being educated. They may still be living at home. So a little bit about my experience homeschooling. I'm the oldest of five children, and my parents started homeschooling us in 1992. And they went on to homeschool for another 26 years. So I started homeschooling personally in first grade and homeschooled all the way through high school. And my parents and arguably are elders in the homeschool community, especially in the Central Texas area. As a family, we helped start a lot of homeschool speech and debate clubs around Texas. And when I graduated from college, or actually while I was still in college, my first company, Brook Audio, was an audiobook publishing company specifically for the homeschool market. So I wasn't just a homeschool student. I was also a homeschool vendor selling books to homeschoolers at homeschool conventions. And I've traveled around the country attending and speaking at homeschool events and conferences. and have gotten opportunities to interact with homeschoolers in other parts of the country, because there are a lot of regional differences with homeschooling. That said, the majority of my experience has been in Texas and amongst Texas homeschoolers. And I know that homeschoolers are very different in certain areas. And where my least amount of knowledge is East Coast homeschoolers. So I haven't interacted with many East Coast homeschoolers, but I have kind of in the West, Arizona, Idaho, California, etc. And I should say also my wife was homeschooled all the way through. Her family were also kind of early homeschool leaders. Her dad ran our local homeschool organization, was on the board of our local homeschool organization, helped put on our major local homeschool conference every year. And so, but I do want to give a disclaimer that while I understand parts of the homeschooling market, I feel like I have a good perspective. There are literally hundreds of different homeschool communities around the country, and each one is a little bit different from the others. And what I'm going to be talking about in this episode, in part, is the history of homeschooling. So I feel like the history of homeschooling helps you understand a lot about the current state of homeschooling, and also helps you understand the kind of fundamental different groupings that homeschoolers are in. And so it's important to realize that there's no homeschool market, but rather separate homeschool markets. There's lots of different kinds of markets. And I'm going to be talking about the psychographic and demographic differences between these groups of people and how you can target them with your books. But just realize that a homeschool community in suburban California is going to be very different from a homeschool community in rural South Carolina. All right, so let's talk about the five major streams of homeschooling. And as I talk about these five streams of homeschooling, I'm going to be talking a lot about the history of homeschooling, a lot of which I experienced firsthand. But I should give a disclaimer that while these streams tend to represent how homeschoolers congregate, they don't represent how homeschoolers see themselves. These are not self-identifying terms. These are marketing groupings. And one of the things I've learned being marketing a long time is that people who you're marketing to don't like to know about the groupings that you put them in for marketing purposes, even if those groupings are very useful. So I know many of you listening are homeschoolers, so I don't want you to be offended. And I do want to acknowledge that every homeschool family is a unique snowflake, and it will not be hard to find exemptions to these observations. But as a marketer, and if you're an author, you're a marketer, it's very helpful to see while everyone is different, there are things that people have in common. And finding those things that they have in common are how you market to them. So just because an observation is not universally true does not mean it can't be generally helpful. And so I just want to say that because I realize a lot of people who are new to marketing are like, no, I know somebody who's an exception to that. That's not why they did it, blah, blah, blah. And it's like that, while being helpful for that one person or that one family isn't helpful generally when it comes to selling books. And, you know, people have very complex motivations, and that needs to be acknowledged. So let's start with the first stream of homeschoolers, and these are what I call the hippie homeschoolers. In the 1970s, maybe a little bit earlier than that, but predominantly in the 1970s, the first wave of homeschoolers kind of emerged onto the scene. And these were hippies, believe it or not. Their parents didn't want the man indoctrinating their children or couldn't be bothered to take them to school. Perhaps they were living in a commune. A good representation of this early homeschool culture is the best-selling book Possum Living, which I will link to in the show notes. This is about a father and his daughter who lived off the grid, not paying taxes, and living off the land for about $1,000 a year. So it's how they lived on $1,000 a year, which was not a lot of money, even in the 1970s. And they were secular. They didn't have strong religious motivations. And they're also, at least in this book, they used an approach called unschooling that eschews curriculum in favor of curiosity-driven education. And similar in some ways to the Montessori method, but also different from the Montessori method. It's very libertarian. If you could think of, you know, what is the kind of curriculum that libertarian hippies would come up with. So in Possum Living, they described making their own moonshine, which they drank together. And, you know, these hippie homeschoolers, it wouldn't have been uncommon for them to be growing their own marijuana. And they were very happy to break laws that forbid homeschooling because they were already living kind of in opposition to the state, in opposition to mainstream culture. And this group of homeschoolers still exists today. It's probably the smallest group. And they're also the least likely to show up at stuff because their values of independence and self-reliance and the eschewing of traditional culture and mainstream culture and even traditional morality cause them to be very independent. They're very much on the edges of civilization. But possum living, they were literally living on the edges of civilization. And, you know, this is the kind of homeschooler that smokes pot and has purple hair and spent a few years living in a commune at one point in the 90s. Although I will say the main character of Possum Living, which is a true story, did go on to work at NASA. So unschooling, you know, while you may think, you know, how can you have a good education without a curriculum? You can still get a good education without a curriculum. And, you know, she went on to get a very good education and get into college back when it was weird to get into college as a homeschooler. I would estimate that across the nation, there's maybe 50,000 hippie homeschoolers, and they're mostly living in rural areas. So these are not urban hippies. These are rural hippies. All right. So the second stream of homeschooling is what I call the fundamentalist homeschoolers. And this started in the 1980s. You'll find some that started even sooner than that. But the main kind of flow really got started in the early 80s and just grew and grew and grew through the 80s. And the kind of the triggering point for a lot of these homeschoolers was the sex education that started entering schools in the 1980s. They didn't believe in that. They didn't agree with the way public schools were teaching sex education. They didn't like how public schools were handing condoms to their children. And so it was kind of a reaction to the sex, drugs, and rock and roll of the 80s and that was prevalent in the schools. Parents started pulling their children out of the public school system so they could have more control over the morality and character education of their children. And because of this really strong religious motivation, they were willing, like the hippies before them, to break the law in order to homeschool their children. And I will say, when we started homeschooling was right around the time that homeschooling was officially legal. So in a lot of states, and Texas was this way, homeschooling was in a gray area where it was unclear, the laws were unclear whether or not it was legal to homeschool or not. So and even after it officially became legal, that wasn't, you know, widely known outside the homeschool community. So I still remember like having the blinds drawn so the trash truck couldn't see you and being very careful about the postman and, you know, being afraid of the police all growing up that they would take me away and put me in a public school. It was very much a fear that we had in the early days that the later generations of homeschoolers did not have. As more people got familiar with homeschooling and as homeschooling had a better reputation in the community in general, we suffered less persecution. I'll just put it that way. But these early fundamentalists were willing to suffer persecution because they were primarily religiously motivated. Now, the academic benefits of homeschooling for these homeschoolers were the icing on the cake, but ultimately their primary motivation was a religious one. And this stream is the biggest segment of homeschooling to this day. It counted by children, partly because it's very common amongst fundamentalist homeschoolers to have a lot of children. There's various reasons for this. There was actually people in the community in the early days who were encouraging having a lot of children. In fact, there are some streams of homeschooling that believe that using any kind of birth control is sinning against God. And so you're obligated to have as many children as you possibly can to fill the world and be as fruitful and multiply. So that's where you see the like 12 plus families. But even amongst homeschoolers that don't kind of buy into that, it's still not uncommon to see 4, 5, 6 children as kind of a normal size family. So while in the kind of mainstream culture, two children, between 2 and 3 children is common for married couples, In general, amongst fundamentalist homeschoolers, you're closer to going to see between 3 and 6 as the range is that this kind of normal and not uncommon to find families that have even more. And those families that have even more have kind of disproportionate influence in the community because they just have so many more children to be active, right? When there's one family that's 1/3 of your basketball team, that family has a lot of influence because they just have so many members of the team, or that one family of 12 kids and four of those kids are all in your speech and debate club. That family has a lot of influence. This group is also the poorest, typically, because they are living off of a single income and they have so many children. And another thing to realize about fundamentalist homeschoolers is that they're very matriarchal. So, and this is due to the number of children they have in many ways. So because they have so many children, they typically have to live farther away from the urban center where the jobs are, because that's where you can get houses, large houses, cheaply, right? The closer you are to the kind of working area of your town, you know, where the jobs are, the more expensive houses are on a per square foot basis. So in order to fit all of their children, they move farther and farther away into the rural areas, while the dad is often still working in that urban center, doing a blue-collar job, white-collar job. You find the whole gamut amongst homeschoolers, especially fundamentalist homeschoolers. And so that father is the sole breadwinner, so he's got to work, and he's got a killer commute. So he doesn't spend a lot of time with the family because of these reasons, which means, and especially not a lot of time amongst the family during homeschooling hours, like during school hours, which means that the academic decisions, the book buying decisions, and a lot of the parenting decisions are being made by the mother. And this is really important to understand if this is the market that you're selling to. You are not selling to homeschool dads. There's this stereotype of like the, you know, iron-fisted patriarchal dad in homeschooling. And while that stereotype does exist, and you will find dads that are like that, the far more common thing that you'll observe is dads that are just not present. Not because they don't care, they care passionately, but because the kind of economic circumstances make it really hard for them to be present very much, right? When you are, you know, working 9 hours at work to try to feed all of your family, and you have a 1 hour commute on both sides of that, that is 11 hours that you are not home with your kids. and that's what you're doing to provide for them. So keep that in mind, that a lot of dads work really hard to feed all of those mouths on just one salary. There's not a lot of single income households in the United States, right? That number is falling every year because it's really hard to live in the United States, especially to live in a city in the United States with just one income. And so the homeschool dads have it rough. So just keep that in mind. In terms of the location, the fundamentalist homeschoolers are predominantly suburban, but kind of like the edge of suburban, right? So they're not necessarily as much in that first suburb as they are in that second suburb, and even in rural areas. You'll find some in the cities, but the density is much lower. I remember when I was younger, seeing a billboard in the middle of Austin for a homeschooling convention. I remember just shaking my head. I'm like, no one driving by this billboard homeschools. It's not something that people in deep urban areas do in any significant numbers. Like, I knew all three homeschool families that were in that neighborhood, and there was only three in that whole like region of town. All right, so we talked about the hippie homeschoolers in the 70s that started in the 70s. We talked about the fundamentalist homeschoolers that started in the 80s. Now let's talk about the academic homeschoolers. And the academic homeschooling stream of the movement didn't really get started until the 1990s. And I want you to try to remember the 1990s. They were a low point in America's opinion of its own public school system. Now, Bill Clinton had a radical plan to revolutionize the way schools were done. And George Bush had basically the same plan called No Child Left Behind that were major, major changes in homeschooling, in education, because we were losing confidence in our own public schools. And a lot of children, or a lot of parents in this decade, pulled their children out of their local public school because they didn't have confidence that their child was going to get a good education. So these academic homeschoolers kind of fit into two major categories. And those are academic homeschoolers that are Christians, but their primary motivation for educating their children was an academic one, right? These are the kind of Christian parents that might have their kids in public school for a few years and then take them out for a few years, put them in private school. This is kind of one of the giveaways of this kind of homeschoolers, that they kind of bounce in and out of schooling and they are reevaluating every year, what will give my child the best education? But there's also a very big secular group of these kinds of homeschoolers, where they are not religiously motivated, or they're not Christian motivated. Maybe they have some alternative religion. Maybe they're New Age or something else, but they're educating predominantly for academic reasons. One of the things that's often different with academic homeschoolers is that the parents are more likely to have college educations and even postgraduate educations. These are educated parents who want a very good education for their parents. They live in nicer neighborhoods. They're wealthier. While there's, you know, often still just one breadwinner, that's a breadwinner who's, say, an officer in his company or, you know, is making a lot of money. So these are the, you know, they live in nice neighborhoods near a Costco. This is kind of where I want you to picture these homeschoolers living. And a part of the stream are also the parents of savants and geniuses, you know, the whiz kids, you know, the kids who are done with high school by age 12. And part of the reason why they're homeschooling their children is to allow their child to, you know, learn at an accelerated pace. And, you know, I had a lot of friends who were in this group of homeschoolers growing up who were, you know, 16 years old and taking college classes. Not at all uncommon for these academically motivated homeschoolers. So I do want to reiterate that academic homeschool families tend to see homeschooling as an option, whereas fundamentalist families tend to see homeschooling as a calling from God, a religious obligation and their duty to their children. This is kind of the main way that I kind of split these, because that motivation really affects how you market to them, how you message them. If you're going to try to sell a book to a homeschool mom who's an academically motivated homeschool mom predominantly, you're going to be talking more about the learning of the book, you know, the things that you're going to learn from reading the book, how you'll be, your mind will be edified. Whereas if you're selling to a religiously motivated homeschool mom, you're going to be talking about the character, right? You're going to be talking about the religious transformation that this book can bring in the heart of your children. Now, that's not to say that the academics don't care about religion or the fundamentalists don't care about academics, but we're talking about their primary motivation. And you're always going to sell more books speaking to someone's primary motivation than you will speaking to their secondary motivation. In the academic stream, you see more diversity in terms of politics. You'll see more liberal parents. You'll see more permissive parents and less sheltering, right? Because that's not their motivation. And I will say that the secular academics, there's kind of systemic discrimination against them. So a lot of the homeschool organizations have policies that keep the secular academics and the non-Christian academics out. So you have to sign a statement of faith if you want to play on the basketball team. You have to sign a statement of faith if you want to be a part of the homeschool choir. And you have to sign a statement of faith to be a part of the debate club, right? They are kind of systemically excluded from a lot of events. Even I think some book fairs, you have to sign statement of faith just to come in and buy books. And so the result is that the secular academics have often their own alternative organizations and institutions to kind of assist in the homeschooling. So in a community, you might find, you know, two different basketball teams, the one that's run by the secular academics, and one that's run by the fundamentalists. And the Christian academics kind of have the best of both worlds, because they are happy to do the secular activities, right? They're not insisting that their basketball team have a statement of faith, but they're also able to, in good conscience, sign the statement of faith if they want to be a part of the Christian basketball team. Keep that in mind as you're marketing, that this academic stream, while it's a single stream in terms of motivation, it's a single stream in terms of like how I would message to them, realize that part of this group is pushed aside by the mainstream of the community. So I remember when I was a student, back when I was a homeschool student, there was a big hullabaloo because one of the local homeschool choirs allowed Mormons to participate. And a lot of Christian parents, a lot of fundamentalist parents did not like that. They did not like the idea of their child singing next to a Mormon child in their choir. And so that was kind of the big point of contention, or was a point of contention amongst homeschoolers back in those days. So some quick stats. This is mostly the academic homeschoolers are mostly suburban, but they're more likely than fundamentalist homeschoolers to live in kind of urban areas, right? Of the homeschoolers that homeschool in apartments, I would venture to guess most of them are in this academic stream. And I would estimate maybe around a million homeschoolers are from this stream of motivation. All right, so the fourth stream of homeschooling is what I'm going to categorize as special needs homeschooling. This is the stream of kind of, it's almost a photo negative of the academic stream. So while the academic stream, they're homeschooling because their children are brilliant, the special needs homeschoolers are homeschooling because their children have some sort of challenge for whatever reason. Now, that challenge may be that they are a professional, right? They're a professional actor. They're trying to become a professional gymnast. But more likely, it's because they have a debilitating illness or some sort of physical, emotional, or other special need that makes going to school every day challenging, right? They have a handicap of some kind. Or there's some sort of relational challenge, right? There's a bully problem in their school, or maybe they have extreme autism, something like that. And I would also put into this category the location challenge. So missionary kids living in a remote area of a foreign country, I would put into this kind of stream of homeschooling, right? These are people who aren't homeschooling necessarily by choice, right? It's not like they woke up one day and they're like, I've decided we're going to homeschool. It's, you know, life has happened. They're living in the middle of a desert in the middle of nowhere, and there is no school to go to, especially no English school to go to. And so they are forced by circumstance to homeschool, or, you know, their child has some severe physical disability that keeps the child from being able to go and participate fully in the public school. And of the different streams, this is the stream that's the least likely to identify themselves as homeschoolers. In fact, it's not uncommon for a parent of this kind of child, you know, let's say they have two or three children, they may have their other two children in public school, and only their special needs child is the one who's not in public school, but they're still going to the high school football games, and, you know, they're still a part of that community. Whereas the other homeschool streams have their own football games, they have their own proms. These are the ones who are still going to the main public school prom. And they're also the group most accepted by the public school system. Public school system actually is really goes out of its way to accommodate special needs children. And while at least in Texas, they won't spend a penny on a homeschool child doing anything, even though those homeschool parents pay taxes just like everyone else, the public school will spend a fortune helping the special needs children, sometimes bringing tutors to their house or other things to help them. And much more flexible, right? It's like, oh, you can come to school and only take this one class, right? That's fine. And a part of this is financially motivated. Having special needs children in your school unlocks federal funds that you don't get if you don't have that child. So the public school's very happy to have a special needs child involved in some way so they can unlock all of that money. And in some ways, this is the oldest group, even though they don't really identify as homeschoolers, and they weren't the ones who like pioneered, right? The hippies who kind of pioneered and figured this thing out way in early days. While this group is older, they are kind of less, from a marketing perspective, they're a little trickier to challenge because they're more like mainstream culture. And the homeschool moms of this kind of student aren't buying as many books, partly because they're only buying the books for the one child, right? The other children are going and getting their books from the public school the way normal moms get their books, or non-homeschooling moms, I should say. Homeschooling is normal now. So I would say this is, you'll find special needs children across the spectrum, but, you know, mostly suburban, but mostly just because most children grow up in suburban areas, or many children grow up in suburban areas. And I would estimate the size around 250,000, but I don't have good data on that. And again, how much at home they are as opposed to how much they are in, you know, the school, right? Maybe it makes it a little hard to judge when they're homeschooling and when they're just staying home from school because they're sick. or for whatever other reason. All right, the final stream of homeschooling, and this is kind of the most recent stream, or what I call second generation homeschooler. So homeschooling's been around long enough that the children who grew up as homeschool students are now going on to homeschool themselves. At least some of them go on to homeschool themselves. And this is a stream that I'm a part of now, right? So my wife and I have decided to homeschool our children, especially in the early years. We are not as dogmatic, though, about homeschooling as our parents were. So our parents really, from time to time, they entertained the idea of stopping to homeschool. They never really entertained it in any serious way. Whereas for us, it's kind of more of an ongoing conversation. But we're definitely committed to it for the foreseeable future, because we both come from homeschooling families. And in some ways, this is the part of the movement I have the least visibility into, because we're not homeschooling yet. I mean, we are. We read lots of books to our daughter, but she's only 1 year old. So there's only so much education we can do. But she does read a lot of books. And I will say, and from a book-selling perspective, I will say proto-homeschoolers, right? The kinds of parents who are planning to homeschool in the future are already likely the kind of homeschoolers that have book-buying problems. I think we have over 100, maybe closing in on 200 children's books. We'll open up our own children's library of children's books. We have so many. So I'll just kind of share some of my observations here. But again, I don't feel as confident in these observations because they're not as wide ranging. But the second generation homeschoolers seem to be less. They seem to be less idealistic, less dogmatic, less passionate, less insecure. They're more confident in their homeschooling. And for them, it's more normal. And it's less of an identity. Growing up, being a homeschooler was a big part of my psychological identity, our family psychological identity. And it's just not as much as our identity moved forward. Like, I'm not going to like identify as a homeschool dad. It's like, that's how I see myself. Another thing I want to reiterate is these second generation homeschoolers, they're more secure. And to kind of explain what that means, I should probably explain some of the insecurities that the early pioneers of homeschooling had. I remember when my family started homeschooling, we were one of the first in our community to publicly, you know, announce to the world that we were homeschooling, right? Other families have been doing it secretly, kind of hiding from the government. We were one of the early ones to announce it. And I remember going to like public school dumpsters and digging through their dumpsters because it was being announced when a public school was throwing away their curriculum. Homeschoolers don't have to do that anymore. There are a lot of curriculum options. But in 92, there weren't very many. And a Saxon math answer key was gold. You couldn't buy them at the time. Now Saxon Math has realized there's a lot of money to be made selling homeschoolers, and the whole market has shifted. But I remember doing a service project at our church, because one of the homeschool books had recommended, do a service project for your church and help them know that you are not weird, that you're a valuable part of the church. So I remember it was the first time I'd ever been in a woman's bathroom. I went in to clean the women's bathroom of our church. Nobody was there, right? But it was a part of a service project that we did. We may have done it with another homeschool family. I don't remember. But those are the sorts of things that were kind of born out of an insecurity, right? It's like afraid of criticism and kind of ostracism because we're doing this weird, strange thing, that modern day homeschoolers don't have that, right? They don't have that fear, especially second generation homeschoolers. For them, homeschooling is normal, and they are, their community has adapted and adjusted, right? So thanks in no small part to those early pioneers doing those sorts of things like service projects at their church and, you know, having those awkward conversations with their families as they come out of the closet and be like, yes, we're homeschooling and we've been homeschooling for the last 2 years. You know, our children haven't been in a public school since 1985 or whatever, right? That has happened. The culture has accepted homeschooling. And so we have less to prove, I guess, is one way to say it. So a little less angsty in the second generation, a little less extreme. And we're taking fewer risks so as well, which I think is an important thing to mention. So that's kind of the history of the homeschool market. Hopefully it helps you understand the different kinds of homeschoolers. Real quickly, I want to share some of my kind of prognostications of what I think will be happening in the future of the homeschool market. So like where homeschooling is moving. So the first one is that there's a big leadership shift. And when I first wrote this, the shift hadn't really started. Now the shift is actively happening. In fact, a lot of it has already happened, where the first generation of leaders are stepping down. And you know, there was a lot of people, and it's mostly men, who were running the homeschool movement in the sense of like being in charge of various institutions that were kind of pivotal in homeschooling. And a lot of these men are retiring. They're getting to the age where they're no longer wanting to do this anymore. Some of them are leaving because of scandal, but some of them are just, you know, they've served their time after 30 years. They're ready for the next generation to take over. They're wanting to step down into a less active role. And so this is creating a leadership vacuum of, you know, because they're all kind of doing it all at the same time. Because homeschooling, especially fundamentalist homeschooling, all started in the same decade amongst baby boomers predominantly. A lot of those baby boomers are starting to retire, and they're all retiring near the same, you know, five-year window. It'll be curious to see who the new leaders are of this new movement. I would keep an eye on Alex and Brett Harris, their father. The Harris family has always been very influential in the homeschooling world. And, you know, I feel like they're bellwethers in some ways. But, you know, who knows who the next leaders are going to be. I will say that the Harris brothers, Alex and Brett, have already started to kind of challenge that matriarchal homeschool culture a little bit with their book, Do Hard Things. So they're already doing that a little bit, but it remains to be seen. I don't think either of them have children of homeschool age yet, and they may not be motivated, but the crown is theirs for the taking if they want it. But a lot of these institutions will be shifting over to second-gen homeschoolers who are likely, in many cases, will be the new leaders. The challenges that the homeschool leadership face are also changing. So in the first kind of generation of homeschoolers, the challenges were primarily external, right? Legal battles to have homeschooling officially legalized in your state, or, you know, protecting homeschoolers from various forms of persecution. There's still legal battles to be fought, but now they're more often in the form of homeschoolers trying to get state funds, right? They're trying to get some of that sweet, sweet tax money like everybody else, which is a very different kind of battle than like a fighting for your own existence kind of battle, which is what I remember fighting when I was young. You know, we were very politically involved because our whole way of life was at risk every time the Texas legislature was meeting. And so we had to make sure that our voices were heard. So the challenges that the new wave of leaders are going to face are internal challenges, kind of dealing with issues within the homeschool community. So there's a big homeschool sexual predator problem inside the community, and that needs to be addressed. It needs to be acknowledged, it needs to be fixed, and we need leaders who are willing to do that, and not leaders who, because they're dealing with external things, are trying to pretend that those internal problems don't exist. Which, you know, when you're primarily dealing with the barbarians at the gates, you don't want to acknowledge the problems on the inside, or you're less willing to do that. Also, dealing with disillusioned homeschool graduates, often because of the sexual predator problem, there's a lot of very unhappy homeschool graduates who are very hostile to homeschooling. In fact, probably the biggest opponents to homeschooling right now are homeschool graduates themselves. Some of them who had really bad experiences for one reason or another. And because the mainstream culture doesn't really care anymore. Right. During the 90s, there was lots of drama about homeschoolers, and they were winning spelling bees. And you're like, is this okay? Now, homeschoolers can get into any college they want. Mainstream culture has accepted homeschooling. And with the exception of like teachers' unions, there's very few groups that are out with a vendetta against homeschooling. But, you know, these homeschool anonymous type groups are, right? They're the ones who remain with a vendetta against homeschooling. And so managing those external but also internal challenges, right? Because these homeschool alumni, they're internal, right? They grew up homeschooled. They still, in some cases, identify as homeschooled, but they're angry, and sometimes for good reason, because they were harmed. And so those are the issues that the new leaders are going to have to face. And if you're dealing with leaders, just kind of keep in mind the new challenges that they're facing. Another trend that's happening is mainstreamification of homeschooling and the adoption of homeschooling in the kind of the general community. So we've already talked about this quite a bit, but a new big trend that I've been watching very closely is what's called the university model private schools. So these are private schools that are hybrid between homeschooling and kind of traditional private schooling, where you go to class 2 days a week or 3 days a week, or maybe just 1 day a week. This was experimented with in the early days when I was young. So when I was 14 years old, I taught a 2-semester class on web design at our very first a la carte co-op in town. So, which is a great learning experience for me. I also took classes at the co-op, but, you know, since it was so new, there was no rules and no rule against a 14-year-old teaching a high school class. So I taught a high school class. But at the time, that was very new. These like co-ops were kind of new and experimental. Now there are like companies that run the co-ops, you know, and they have profit motives and professionalism and, you know, continuity. And it's not just a bunch of parents donating their time. This mainstreamification, also kind of industrialization, I guess you could say, is affecting homeschooling quite a bit. And then the final big trend that I'm observing that's kind of happening more and more, and I predict it will happen even more in the future, is more diversity. So in the early decades of homeschooling, homeschooling was mostly white evangelical. In fact, white evangelical, you know, fundamentalist evangelical, with the exception of the secular homeschoolers that we've already talked about. And that's happening less and less. We're seeing a lot more diversity, not just ethnic diversity, but also cultural diversity. More communities are starting to homeschool. Some migrant communities are getting into homeschooling, and also more religious groups, right? Because if you're a Orthodox Jew or a very strict Muslim, you have some of the same concerns over that same sex education that your children are getting at school. And maybe you don't feel like your religion is going to be acknowledged or protected in the school. And so you are wanting to pull your children out for religious reasons, but it's a different religion, right? That diversity is growing in the homeschool community. And the homeschool community is becoming more accepting. Some of the early leaders, like Bill Gothard, were famous like for rejecting any music with an African influence because it was evil, because it was African. Like, there's really strong, like sometimes not even subtle, just like overt racism. Some of the most extreme racism I ever encountered growing up was in the homeschool community, right? There, and again, lots of different communities. And a lot of this is regional. So California community is much less likely to be racist than one in, say, South Carolina or Alabama. But even you'll find communities there that are very accepting. So I want to be very careful with my language here. But in general, in the early days, you just didn't see a lot of diversity. And now you're seeing more of it. And I think we're going to see even more of it moving forward. So I hope this has been helpful, kind of to help you understand the homeschool community. If you're wanting to sell books into the homeschool community, I have another episode kind of further on of this guide that I wrote that's like specific, practical tips and how to put together specific strategies. But I'll say in the meantime, while I'm finishing that and also observing the feedback, because I'm very curious what you think of this episode, whether you agree with it or not, and what your observations of the homeschool community have been, I'll give you a couple of quick tips on marketing. And the first one is get to know a homeschooler in real life. If you're not a part of the community yourself and you're wanting to sell to the community, you need to get to know some real honest to goodness homeschool families. Chances are there's some at your church. So, you know, get to know them, get to be friends with them. And the second thing is to start attending homeschool events. You know, volunteer to be a judge at a homeschool speech and debate tournament. This is probably the easiest entry into the homeschool community. Homeschool speech and debate tournaments are always desperate for judges, and the barrier for entry is very low. You don't have to be a part of the community to judge a speech and debate round. And you don't have to be educated, right, in public speaking. You'll learn a lot attending it. But the whole idea is that the students are wanting to be trained to speak to regular people, not people who've had an education on how to listen to them. And there's often free food in it for you. So the organization, there's several different homeschool speech and debate leagues. The one that I was a part of is the NCFCA. And I'll put some links to the various homeschool speech and debate programs in the show notes if you want to check those out. And you can see if there's any tournaments in your area. And often those tournaments will have websites where you can very, very easily register to be a judge. And once you register to be a judge, you'll never be lonely again. They'll ask you back at all future events, especially if they find out that you're a writer. I think they would love to have you as a part of the judging. So those are a couple of quick tips. They're going way over time. But real quickly, our sponsor today is the Christian Writers Institute. And we don't have a course of the week, but rather a heads up. Black Friday's coming up and Cyber Monday are coming up. And we have huge deals for both of those with the Christian Writers Institute, but they're only going to be available for people on the CWI mailing list. So go to ChristianWritersInstitute.com and sign up for the mailing list so you don't miss out on these amazing bundles. You are not going to want to miss them. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to the Christian Publishing Show. For more information and to get episodes delivered to your phone automatically, visit ChristianPublishingShow.com.